I have no financial relationships to disclose. Thank you all this morning. I'm very honored to be on this panel. This is some wonderful research that you all are doing. I'm coming to this from a little bit of a different angle as a recent victim of the disaster who was kind of thrown into an environment where the entire social and physical infrastructure around us collapsed from Hurricane Ike in September of 2008. And at the time, there were some choices that we had to make as a center based within an academic university context in Galveston, Texas, about whether we wanted to try to continue business as usual or whether we really felt like we had to try to orient our work towards the crisis that was facing the city of 50,000, 60,000 people where we lived. We made a commitment to really try to engage a process that we felt probably would be a bit different from the way people usually do this sort of thing, but that we felt might actually be able to have some potential for impact in the nearer term rather than the longer term. So just to give you a little bit of background, my team and I live on Galveston Island off the southeast coast of Texas. This is a map of the island, and we had the red line is the track of Hurricane Ike, and it was a storm with an extremely, it was a very large storm. It really took up the entire Gulf of Mexico, and with that created about a 15-foot surge that our island was, it's a barrier island, it was, we were not prepared for this. And the surge was turning in a counterclockwise direction, and so what we got was some very significant waves of water that picked up the sediment off the ground floor and dumped it over the entire island. And these two red circles that you see are some neighborhoods that I want you to pay some kind of particular attention to as we go through and show you what we tried to do to advance a health and all policies approach in this community. These were neighborhoods that were especially vulnerable in terms of socioeconomic status. And so after the storm, what we did was we kind of took stock a little bit. We 70% of the houses and businesses in Galveston were destroyed or badly damaged. Before the storm, poverty and health and social indicators were already pretty poor. We had a very large public housing contingent in Galveston, and there were a lot of social problems. The tax base was really weak. The employment base was not well distributed. Post-Ike, we had significant changes in the demographic composition of the island, especially having lost and not regaining quickly a lot of our lower income populations. The availability of resources and services is obviously significantly reduced for a long time. Our infrastructure was badly damaged. Our social networks were disrupted, and we didn't even know what we were dealing with because we didn't have information on what was going on in the city in terms of who was there, what people had access to, what were their needs. The university where I worked was closed temporarily, and there was really a question for a period as to whether they were going to invest the money to rebuild it. They did, but they also, a toll was taken on the faculty and staff. We lost 1,200 faculty and staff, and the Center to Eliminate Health Disparities was reduced to one person. Everyone else was let go. At the same time, we saw an opportunity, and I mean the royal we at that point, because that was just me at that point. And what I really wanted to do was kind of look at the concept that maybe I had been working in health and all policies research I had been I was very privileged to serve on the secretariat of the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health, and that commission had really tried to promote a health in all policies approach. It was an approach that is just beginning to take some steam in the United States, which is really fantastic. And I wanted to see if maybe some of the usual problems that you see in intersectoral action and health in all policies approaches might be might have a different kind of dynamic in a post-disaster environment. So the idea was that perhaps a post-disaster planning environment affords opportunities for accelerating local planning to address social determinants of health and health disparities through intersectoral actions and health in all policies approach. So we were able to actually get some NIH money very quickly through the ERA funds. And what we decided to do was to adapt the Healthy Development Measurement Tool, which is a tool that was developed out of the San Francisco Department of Public Health that basically includes 125 health-related indicators in reference to the built environment along the six areas that you see. And we weren't going to be able to do all of them because we didn't have the data to, but we wanted to see if there were ways to prioritize some of the indicators that we felt could most effectively contribute to the local recovery planning that we knew was about to go full force in our community. I have included more slides in this presentation than I'll go through in detail because I wanted there to be a record in the official APHA for people who go online. You can see all of the details, but we don't have planned time to go through all of the details today. But specifically, we wanted to improve, our goal was to improve pro-health planning and to try to work towards institutionalizing health and all. health impact assessment approaches and health in all policies approaches. And we knew that this was not going to be a clean research project. This was going to be a very engaged, responsive, adapted sense of cooperation with our community that would require us to be quite nimble sometimes. We knew that we needed to link to existing collaborative structures because it wasn't appropriate for us to lead, nor did we have the resources to lead in terms of the implementation of and development of specific policy. So our function was really to serve as research support and training support, and we found that often we actually really had to also take on a coordination support to push the work forward. We wanted to create demand and also to be responsive to demand-driven priorities once people kind of understood what we were doing. And eventually, we wanted to be able to transfer some of the skills and the thinking into local government and community organizations. So this is just kind of a sample of some of the different groups that we intentionally linked with. The first one was the Long-Term Recovery Committee, you know, the FEMA disaster group that they come in, FEMA comes in and they set up a little disaster group and it's usually like 6 people, 12 people. We had 300 members on our recovery committee, so this was really a problem. They came up with 47 projects that they recommended for development, and that was way too many for us to even be able to engage the process effectively. So we also looked for some other opportunities. Including social services block grant funding to set up community workshops on social determinants of health to try to help build an educated constituency, resident constituency in the city who understood the issues of social determinants of health because there's so little public knowledge and recognition about it, and who could hopefully eventually start to form some of our public supporters in this process. We also kind of tried to link with group, you know, after a disaster is a great time for all of the disaster planners to come out of the woodwork and get busy on that again. So we also wanted to link with disaster preparedness and resiliency efforts because we felt like that was an opportunity to talk about some of these issues in terms of prevention for the next round. We also, Galveston decided to develop a new neighborhood master plan. So we were able to actually link with that committee and provide specific input on decision making that the committee would be proposing that would allow them to guide the proposals towards healthier choices. There were also a number of other groups that we linked with. the key driving issues, and I'm just going to give you a couple examples today. We looked at a number of things, and we have a whole book of maps if anyone's specifically interested, but housing, food security, and childcare in ECD. And I'm just going to give you the housing example today. If you want more information on the food security and childcare examples, you can look at the presentation on the website. But our, basically in housing, the city, our goal was, as the city decided how it was going to rebuild, how it was going to bring back 569 public housing units in the city, we wanted to encourage them to consider decentralization of the units to create mixed income communities and to desegregate. And very explicitly, we realized that there was no possibility of actually including as a goal reintegration of the displaced population in any reasonable sense, because so many people, 2 years out, we still don't have a housing plan for these units. And it's not realistic to think that many people are going to repopulate those houses. This is a map of Galveston again. The pink areas indicate some of the places where the public housing was prior to the storm. All of it was destroyed and razed. To give you a little more context, and I'm sorry that the maps are not quite lined up with each other, but the darkest areas are areas of extreme poverty in Galveston. So you see that the public housing was located in areas of poverty, but there was poverty that reached beyond the public housing too. All of that housing was pretty much been destroyed. There are very few houses in those very poor areas, especially towards the water on the top that actually have survived. Segregation was also concentrated in those areas. And the recovery process has been much slower in those areas, if you look at the number of building permits that have been issued. So one of the problems that we're having in this is, you know, a reality of this kind of dynamic process is that we don't have plans for the Housing Authority yet to bring back housing into Galveston Island. And so it's very difficult to anticipate the health impact assessment of their plans when we don't have the plans. And so we're a year into the work. We have another year on it. And so we'll be looking at that quite soon. But what we are hoping that they will consider as the policy option of preference is to use infill housing towards mixed income and desegregated neighborhoods. And I'm just going to skip right to the end and just give you a couple of the lessons that we came away with. One is that there are some opportunities to really advance and accelerate health in all policies approaches after a disaster, but it has to be a very organized thing. And we've learned a lot of ways that we could help other communities move much more quickly than we were able to do in Galveston because it was quite experimental. We know that there are limited windows of opportunity for this, and with grant funding, especially NIH grant funding, it's very difficult to coordinate those kinds of timings. We know that the connection to the local processes is extremely important, and that hot topics like how to bring public housing back into a community can be quite tricky sometimes. It was so hot that we really couldn't get into that discussion preemptively. And so our next steps are to continue to do the research, but also to link into a recent poverty initiative that's being proposed in Galveston that we think will serve as our champion and our platform for being able to continue to introduce these concepts in relation to housing or food security or early child development. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Okay, thank you, Lexi. This is one of the constraints of having five panelists with a lot of very interesting things to say is we have to marshal our time. But we do have a little bit of time for questions. So are there any questions in the audience that any of us could address?
I don't have a question so much as a thought of what I've been hearing since the Gulf Coast oil disaster from people that felt like there was a big setback emotionally in New Orleans. And that might influence your longevity studies. It'd be interesting in a couple of years to see if you see something that happened related to the last 6 months.
Right. And I mean, coincidentally, our center has actually begun engaging in research looking at the population effects along a 10-mile distance from the coast in Louisiana and Mississippi. And we certainly have seen in the short term a lot of these mental health effects that we've seen post-Katrina. We will be following that very question in our child and family health study to see whether the families that we've been following are equally affected or how they're affected by the oil spill and whether or not it has an influence on any of their outcomes. Do any of the panelists have any comments about that, the oil spill in particular? Ruth, have you seen anything that you'd want to mention
yet? We haven't seen a whole lot of effects from that in New Orleans, but we do actually have a third mobile unit now that is going down to Plaquemines Parish, which is the parish most affected by the oil spill, one day a week. Right now, primarily, I think what they're seeing are just medical services. There aren't a lot of medical services in that area, and so that's basically what the community is embracing at this point. But it's historically has been a fairly closed-off community, so we're having to do a lot of work with kind of building rapport with the community for them to kind of accept mental health services and access those services.
Any other questions, comments, complaints? Yes. Excellent question.
Yes, I love that question, actually. On our pediatric primary care clinic, I now have them doing about five of those during their well child visits. So, and they're so far have been very cooperative with that, although I know it takes a little bit of time. But what we use in our clinic, we use the GAPS for adolescents, so guidelines for adolescent prevention. I believe is what it stands for. So that's what we use for 11 to 18 year olds. And it asks about a lot of different risk behaviors. And it does ask about emotional issues as well. So the adolescent fills it out, but the pediatrician goes through it question by question and talks to the child about any of the red flags that come up with that one. So that's a really good one. We also are using the strengths and difficulties questionnaire as well, which identifies emotional issues also. So screening tools, I think, are basically the best option to just, you know, as the beginning of identifying any of those issues. And then a referral can come out of that if necessary. Just good patient care, I think. I mean, that's what we've found works. Just, you know, that these kids have these issues and, you know, this is the opportunity to identify them. The schools aren't necessarily going to identify those internalizing kids. It's really the best opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. And I think that's the key. As a primary care pediatrician, if you ask primary care providers to screen for something and don't give them the referral sources that they see, they're stuck with knowing information that they need, that they know the kids need.
Absolutely.
Help, but if they don't have any referral sources, that's very frustrating for them. So knowing
yes.
that they can refer, take that first step and refer directly to you,
right.
that makes it easy. And then you can farm out the things that you don't, that you, that are too much for you to deal with and figure out where they need to go. And I think that's most important.
I completely agree. And just building that relationship between mental health providers and pediatricians is really important. So at our clinic, when we receive a referral from a pediatrician, you know, once we get the appropriate releases signed by the parent, I send a letter to the pediatrician saying, thank you for the referral. I've done the evaluation. You know, if you're interested in the results, contact me. And we have a lot of buy-in from our community of pediatricians because of that opening the lines of communication.
I just have another question. I was wondering, in our media-driven society that jumps from disaster to disaster every week, how do you keep up the outrage that people felt, for example, after Katrina, to get funding and resources and people's concern to stay focused on that event if it continues to have health effects?
I think that's... Yeah, that's a difficult issue, definitely. I mean, I think data helps. I mean, I think other people maybe can answer that question as well. But collecting data and, you know, sharing that with the people who need to see it, you know, is a good way. That's not always easy. But I think, I don't know, anybody have any other ideas about that?
In some ways, that feeds into what the National Commission on Children and Disasters is trying to do, which is to institutionalize the resources and the support systems to address these questions so that you're not dependent on outrage, you're not dependent on media cycles to remind you that you have these problems. I think we've all illustrated very clearly what the problems are, and it's not a surprise. I mean, in some ways, it confirms what everybody already suspects. So the trick is, can you institutionalize a lot of that systemic approaches to be able to address these things that we see? Does anybody else have a comment on that?
I was just going to say your hunch about that is really right. And Tom Berkland is a political scientist at North Carolina State, and he's really written extensively on disasters and the policy windows that open up after disasters and how short they are. And even in a disaster, in a catastrophe like Katrina, the policy windows tend to only be about 6 months to a year, and even shorter for more normal events. And so this is obviously a real source of concern, because lots of money, lots of resources are flooded into areas, and oftentimes they're misallocated because they have to be spent in a particular period of time. And so there is a real issue with the structure of how relief is provided and so forth. But I think he's probably written most extensively and really tried to capture how the media drives us, but also how our current policy infrastructure reacts in that sort of way. So it's a really interesting question.
Okay, you know, I'm actually going to close this now and invite you, if you have further questions or comments, to come bring them up here to the panel. But I'd like to thank the panel for what they've offered us today.